Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know, if Antonin Scalia had died after the election, the rollout of Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch last night might have drawn one kind of reaction from Democrats. But Scalia died a year ago, and Merrick Garland was blocked. So the first word today goes to Esther from Rego Park, who called into our special coverage of the rollout last night.
And my feeling is that the seat should only be filled by Merrick Garland because the Republicans stole the seat from Obama. And nobody should be appointed to that seat other than Merrick Garland. Orrin Hatch himself said that if he appointed Merrick Garland, he would definitely be confirmed, and yet they would not even give him a hearing. So again, it's too bad that it's become so politicized, but that's where the Republicans have put us.
Esther in Rego Park calling our special coverage last night. So how should Democrats react to a qualified conservative nominee to fill what they consider a stolen Supreme Court seat? We're about to find out. Let's talk about the man, 49-year-old Denver-based appeals court judge Neil Gorsuch, and the politics surrounding the man. Trump supporters, Merrick Garland supporters, anyone else, welcome to call with your comments and questions. 212-433-WNYC 433-9692. And we welcome two guests for commentary on this nomination. Ellie Mistal, editor-at-large of Above the Law and legal editor for the WNYC Supreme Court podcast, More Perfect, and Elizabeth Price Foley, a law professor at Florida International University, author of the book Liberty for All, Reclaiming Individual Privacy in a New Era of Public Morality. And some of you saw her op-ed in the New York Times yesterday comparing Scalia and Clarence Thomas. Hi, Ellie, and Professor Foley, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
We all know Judge Gorsuch is a conservative, but Elizabeth, to the point of your op-ed, is he more of a Scalia or more of a Clarence Thomas?
Good question. I think he's a little bit of a hybrid. So, for example, one of the things I mentioned in the Times op-ed is the fact that Clarence Thomas had this boldness about his constitutional originalism that led him, for example, to be more apt to disregard existing precedents. And one of the ways he manifested that boldness was to write pretty forcefully that the court should get rid of what's called Chevron deference, where the courts defer to executive branch agencies' interpretations of statutes. And I think that's a good thing because as a constitutional originalist, there's nothing in the Constitution that suggests that the court needs to give the executive branch such deference. And over time, it has tended to aggrandize the executive branch at the expense of Congress. And Judge Gorsuch seems to be very much aligned with Thomas on that and thinks that it needs to be rethought, if not discarded altogether.
The point of your piece, in part, was that Clarence Thomas, for people who lump Thomas and Scalia together very casually, Clarence Thomas is even more of an originalist than Antonin Scalia was. And Ellie, you've also pointed out to me off the air that you think this idea of Chevron deference, which has a lot of listeners going, the what, the law is so complicated, this is so obscure, matters. And matters to who Neil Gorsuch has shown himself to be, correct?
I think it does, but I mean, I just like to say first, right, that when we're talking about whether or not you're conservative enough for Scalia or conservative enough for Thomas, it really shows how far we've lurched outside of the mainstream, right? We're talking exclusively right now about hard right positions, and it's worth noting that there are other centrist justices out there that Trump could have appointed. He didn't, and so we're now in this kind of ball of trying to figure out just how conservative Gorsuch is going to be. On the particular issue of Chevron deference, I mean, I don't think it's actually as complicated as it sounds. It's a simple question of who gets the right, who gets the benefit of the doubt when we're interpreting law. Does the executive branch get the benefit of the doubt, or should the courts take that doubt away from the executive branch and interpret congressional laws for themselves? Gorsuch seems to think that the courts should be more activist in striking down executive branch interpretations of congressional law.
Is it mostly about making rules and regulations, like environmental regulations and stuff like that? Is that why Chevron is mentioned in this breath?
It's Chevron comes from the case, but yeah, it's all up in the EPA, right? And the EPA is an interesting agency to look at in these times. I don't know if a lot of our listeners know, but Gorsuch's mother actually used to head the EPA for Ronald Reagan, and it was a controversial time for that agency there. So obviously, Gorsuch's thoughts on federal agencies will be crucial to his jurisprudence going forward.
Elizabeth, to that point. And it's an interesting story, his heritage, and I don't want to hold Gorsuch responsible for the actions of his mother. How many of us would like our bosses at work to judge us by things our parents did? But his mom, Ann Gorsuch Burford, was this very controversial head of the EPA under President Reagan. She eventually resigned in a scandal, but policy-wise, she cut the EPA budget by like 20% and tried to undo a lot of federal environmental regulation and devolve it to the states, which is exactly where Trump and his EPA nominee Scott Pruitt seem to be. Interesting coincidence of history. But would you say the attitude toward regulation that Neil Gorsuch grew up in is reflected in this Chevron deference position that you talk about?
Look, I don't think it has anything to do with who Gorsuch's mom is any more than my philosophy has to do with who my mom is or my father. I think that he's a very sophisticated jurist who's thought about these issues by himself, and he's perfectly within the mainstream. This issue that he's not in the mainstream is almost, it doesn't pass the laugh test, because there's a wide swath of the mainstream, as I'm sure you all realize and your listeners realize. But if you are any kind of conservative today, whether a moderate conservative, a libertarian conservative such as myself, a far right or social conservative, you are an originalist. And I would say at this point, most originalists also believe that Chevron deference is something that needs to be seriously rethought. Even Scalia was leaning toward that at the end of his career. So I wrote about Chevron deference needing to be discarded years ago. So I think this is very much within the mainstream of conservative thought. I get that it's not within the mainstream of liberal or progressive thought, but that's really not the issue. The issue is it mainstream? And just like living constitutionalism is in the mainstream of progressive or liberal thought, originalism is for conservatives.
Anthony Kennedy would disagree with you. John Roberts would disagree with you. There are Thomas Hardiman, who was on Trump's shortlist, would disagree with you. There are lots
Look,
of
I mean,
conservatives.
That,
there are lots
even,
of conservatives.
Let him finish.
There are lots
back.
Of conservatives who don't believe in hardcore originalism and hardcore textualism. There are other statutory interpretations of the Constitution. Some conservatives, who I disagree with on many issues, believe in other ways of interpreting the Constitution beyond textualism.
Elizabeth, go ahead.
Look. You and I both know there are plenty of liberals these days. Look at Jack Balkin at Yale, who are liberals and are originalists. So originalism is not only a conservative thing. It is a mainstream philosophical way of looking at constitutional interpretation. And it's just, I just don't even think it's plausible to say that it's not, any more than I would sit there and try to argue that living constitutionalism is not a plausible or mainstream interpretive methodology.
Getting away from Neil Gorsuch, and I want to get back to him in a minute, but that's an interesting thought for a lot of our listeners, Elizabeth. What is a liberal originalist? What would that be? What would somebody's packet of views be that would make one a liberal originalist? That sounds like it might be an oxymoron.
Yeah, no, it's not. It actually is an approach to originalism that suggests that you look to the core principle of the text and what that principle was at the time the text was written. And we're not always talking about the founders of, 1787, 1791, who wrote the original Constitution, but we're talking about whatever portion of the text is being interpreted. So, for example, if we're interpreting the 14th Amendment, which has the Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection Clause and a lot of things that liberals and progressives and conservatives, frankly, care very much about, we would be looking at 1868, because that was the date that that was written and ratified by the American people. So a liberal originalist would look to the underlying principle and be guided by that principle, whereas a more conservative or textualist-oriented originalist would look more specifically to the text first. And only if the text was ambiguous in some way would they then go to some sort of historical context to look for an underlying principle.
Elizabeth Price Foley and Ellie Mistal with us as we talk about the nomination of Neil Gorsuch for United States Supreme Court. And to this point, I think, in his introductory statement last night, Judge Gorsuch said something fundamental to the debate these days over judicial nominees, and here it is.
A judge who likes every outcome he reaches is very likely a bad judge, stretching for results he prefers rather than those the law demands.
And Republican Senator Ben Sasse of Kansas amplified on that this morning on Morning Edition. He liked that statement.
Last night, Judge Gorsuch said something in his statement at the White House, which is something I hear that he tells young law students all the time. If, as a judge, you like all of your policy outcomes, if every time you rule in a case, you like the way it was decided, as a private citizen, you look at it and you say, oh, I like this. This advances my goals. There's probably something wrong with you as a judge because your job isn't to get to those policy outcomes. You should lots of times feel as a citizen when you take off your robe, well, that's a bummer. That isn't the outcome I wish would have happened, but that's what the law leads me to.
So, Ellie and Elizabeth, can I ask you both? It doesn't seem to me there are many that's a bummer votes on the Supreme Court these days, if there ever were. Democratic appointees wind up on constitutional questions to be pro-gay rights, pro-affirmative action, pro-abortion rights, pro-campaign finance limits, and Republican appointees generally against those things. In rulings that are supposed to be about constitutional principles, not contemporary policy outcomes. But when do justices today ever actually say that's a bummer, as far as we can tell, Ellie?
I mean, I think that the centrist judges on the court do actually reach that's a bummer decisions kind of all the time. If you look just last term, Stephen Breyer joined the majority in Utah v. Strafe, which upheld a really horrible kind of a horrible Fourth Amendment decision, I think, for most people. But Breyer's jurisprudence led him with the conservatives on that thing. I think Kennedy often ends up with decisions he doesn't personally like. I think Scalia sometimes ended up with decisions that he didn't personally like. So, no, I think Gorsuch's statement was good and was true. We do want judges who will end up deciding against their own kind of demographic interests from time to time.
Elizabeth, anything on that?
Yeah, I think, frankly, there are very few jurists on the Supreme Court, right, left, or center, who are the kind of judges who are purely outcome-oriented. I think the fight in the Supreme Court is always about interpretive methodology. And sometimes, if you're a living constitutionalist, you may reach results that you personally disagree with. I think Breyer is an example of that kind of jurist. And I think if you are an originalist, you sometimes reach results with which you disagree. I think Scalia was a great example of that. So I think it's a rare justice on the Supreme Court who would go to the court not being humbled by the position and take the raw political position that I'm just going to vote the way I think the case ought to come out.
Can I just say, though, I think one of the interesting things is not whether or not Gorsuch is willing to come to decisions that he doesn't personally agree with, but whether Trump is willing to listen to decisions that he doesn't personally agree with. I mean, again, I think it's what as we talked about in the opening, the future here is a question about executive power. These issues about gay rights and abortion rights and civil rights, they're important, but they are so 2016. Going forward, we really have to look at how these justices are going to view executive power, and we're going to have to look at how the executive views judicial oversight of his authority.
Now, is that
I couldn't agree more, by the way, if I may interject.
Please.
There. I absolutely agree that the issue right now in the next century of the Supreme Court is separation of powers, both vertical separation of powers, meaning federalism, and horizontal separation of powers between the judicial, executive, and congressional and the legislative branches. And frankly, I think Gorsuch has a fabulous track record on showing a willingness to preserve that constitutional architecture, which, by the way, is an architecture that is designed, the framers thought, to protect all of us, to protect our individual liberty. So we ought to embrace any justice who wants to preserve the constitutional architecture. And I do believe that Trump seems to get it because he appointed Judge Gorsuch. I think he understands that that is part and parcel of Judge Gorsuch's perspective on the Constitution. And I think what we're going to see is a Republican Congress that's going to very quickly act to pass certain statutes that are, in fact, going to attempt to reset the balance of power between Congress and the executive branch. I fully expect President Trump to sign and not veto those laws. And, in fact, I think we are going to get some restoration of separation of powers that was so badly eroded during the Obama administration.
And maybe this is an area where the two of you agree. Elizabeth, you as a libertarian, as you just called yourself, and Ellie, I don't know how exactly you characterize yourself, but many liberals and some conservatives and libertarians are worried that Trump has authoritarian tendencies, let's just say it. The way he expressed admiration during the campaign for Vladimir Putin's governing style and even Saddam Hussein's strength of leadership. So how much do you see executive power or literally hedges against authoritarianism becoming the challenge for this court? Is that what you were laying out, Ellie?
Yeah, I think that's. I mean, I think that's the challenge for the new, for the next 4 years. And we don't know right now how any of these justices are going to align on those issues because a lot of them haven't been tested. We haven't had an emoluments clause case ever. Just ever, right? We haven't had we don't know
that's whether Trump is in violation of the Constitution because his hotels take payments from foreign governments and things like that.
Exactly. We don't know what the liberals or the conservatives are going to feel about sanctuary cities and whether or not Trump can pull their funding. We don't know what they think about the Muslim ban. We don't know if they're going to call it a Muslim ban. So there are all of these issues that are bubbling up. Now, one issue I think that is good from the Gorsuch nomination. It doesn't look like Trump forced a litmus test on Gorsuch to kind of swear fealty to him and his executive orders. That does not seem to be the case. It could have been, right? Like, let's give him a round of applause for that. It could have been something that Trump required and doesn't look like he did. So Gorsuch has a free hand to kind of interpret cases and controversies as they come to him.
Elizabeth, more on this?
Well, look, I mean, I understand that people are, especially on the left, are very concerned about the fact that Trump has a very strong personality. I get that. But I think there's a big difference, and we need to kind of stay calm here. There's a difference between having a very strong personality and using your strong personality to dismantle the Constitution. I see no indication that President Trump is going to do that. In fact, I see indications to the contrary. Most of the lawyers that he has surrounded himself with are old school mainstream conservatives. Frankly, there's a lot of libertarian lawyers in this administration. And you have to keep this in mind because not only is Trump not a lawyer, and therefore he is inherently sort of more reliant on the lawyers that surround him, but he also is the kind of person, I think, who wants to restore what he sees as some of the imbalances of the Obama administration. Some of their more blatant excesses in terms of separation of powers. So I think he's cognizant of the fact that he needs to honor the constitutional architecture. Of course, time will tell on this. But he was a Democrat until just a few years ago. So I don't think that he has some wild and crazy idea about becoming a dictator or all these other things that people say about him. I think that's just fear because of the fact that he is such a strong personality. But I don't think that's going to play out in reality.
We're talking about the same guy who fired his lawyer over Twitter, right? Like we're talking about the same person? The same person who fired...
It's okay. You can do that. There's nothing separation of powers is
right.
Wrong with that.
And as Nixon showed, you can do that. But it's not something that we normally do. So that's why there's
nothing,
the concern.
But that
right?
has nothing to do with the Constitution. Every president has the right to fire anybody he wants who serves at his pleasure. I mean, that's just a basic principle of constitutional law.
And when the lawyer is telling you that you're violating the Constitution and that's why she won't follow your directives and you fire her, that's a warning sign. So I'm not saying that he is riding in on a horse right now. I'm just saying that there is a reasonable reason for fear.
His immigration order was signed by the office Office of Legal Counsel. The Office of Legal Counsel is are the best lawyers in the country. They include people who are on the left. It was also cleared by the Justice Department, including a lot of people within the Justice Department who are still Obama administration people and are leftovers from that. This was cleared by all of the ways that you're supposed to clear executive orders in the structure of the executive branch. And you had a rogue person who decided she wanted to become sort of the poster child for the progressive movement at the moment, and she defied the president, and she serves at the will of the president, and she should be fired.
We've got both your views on Sally Yates now. And listeners, if you're just joining us, my guests, as we talk about the nomination of Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court, are Elizabeth Price Foley, law professor at Florida International University. Maybe you saw her op-ed in the New York Times comparing Scalia and Clarence Thomas yesterday, and Ellie Mistal, editor-at-large of Above the Law and legal editor for WNYC's Supreme Court podcast, More Perfect. And let's go to our busy phones. Tim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. So I hear all the arguments about Gorsuch, but I really think that they're beside the point, that the Republicans showed utter contempt for the president and for the process. Remember that before Scalia's body was cold, McConnell said they were not going to allow a vote. And Republicans continue to say even if Hillary Clinton was elected, they would not allow a vote. So Merrick Garland is the nominee, or the person who should be considered. Everything else aside is, I think, normalizing this abnormal aberration. We have this person in charge. So I am opposed.
Thank you very much. Bernadette in Brooklyn with, I think, in a way, a response to Tim. Bernadette, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Yes. I mean, I agree with Tim that Merrick Garland should have been considered, absolutely. But my concern is that the Democrats should keep the powder dry here. Because, let me tell you why, because they need 60 votes right now to confirm a nominee. If they fight this and they go down the wire, then the Republicans will put in the nuclear option, and they will, which will mean they'll only need 50 votes. Gorsuch, extremely conservative, but at least qualified and has been a judge. If the Democrats blow this 60-vote majority and it becomes only 50, and Gorsuch is confirmed, then if another justice on the court dies, Trump could appoint virtually anybody. He could appoint Bannon.
So your position is don't risk the nuclear option over Gorsuch, who's more or less qualified. Save it for somebody maybe much worse than Gorsuch from a liberal perspective, who they may need it for?
You put it precisely exactly what I mean, yeah.
Bernadette, thank you very much. Quentin in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hi, Quentin. Quentin, you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So, I just want to say that I think Trump made an excellent choice. I just want to also say that, you know, to the first caller, who said that they, you know, Mitch McConnell wouldn't allow a vote. I see a lot of people forget Justice Scalia died under very questionable circumstances,
and
you know it was almost like out of a play out of Machiavelli's The Prince. So
and Newtown,
you know, I think that
never happened
to do with
either.
Well, but and secondly, Trump did say that he wanted to put somebody in who was in the mold of Justice Scalia. We need a staunch conservative on the Supreme Court like that, you know, because if we had somebody, you know, we wouldn't have the disaster of Obamacare, you know, is a perfect example. Here I am, I'm being forced to buy a product, you know, that I really don't need, you know, that's just my own personal situation, but I'm being forced to buy a product. I mean, clearly that was unconstitutional. Clearly there was some sort of backroom dealings going on, and, you know, they used the wordplay and called it a tax and everything. I mean, this is absurd. So, you know, the American people have spoken. I'm a black conservative. I'm young. And, you know, there's a lot of us out here. And I think, you know, as time goes on, as Trump, you know, continues throughout his presidency, a lot of tables will be turned.
Quentin,
so I just want to.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Call us again. Elizabeth, I know you got to go in a minute. Could Obamacare, well, they're going to repeal Obamacare anyway, one way or another. I guess that's in the political realm now, not the judicial realm.
Right.
Tell me, because a lot of people are out there wondering, it all seems to come down to this for a lot of folks, but we haven't even touched on it. Is Gorsuch going to vote to repeal or overturn Roe versus Wade as wrongly decided, in your opinion, should he get the opportunity?
I don't know. I think that's a terrific question, and I think it will depend on whether he's more like a Scalia or more like a Thomas. And by that I mean something I mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is how does he reconcile the tension that exists sometimes between adhering to precedent, which certainly Roe v. Wade and really later cases like Planned Parenthood versus Casey have established for a long time, the right to terminate a pregnancy, at least prior to viability.
Just so people know, the Casey case in the 90s more or less codified Roe, reaffirmed Roe, even though weakened it a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it tweaked with it around the margin, but basically reaffirmed the idea and the constitutional right. And so does he adhere to the precedent, or does he stick to his fidelity of the original meaning of the Constitution? I think if it's the latter, then I think, there may be 5 votes on the court to overturn Roe. My guess is, though, that there's still not, even with Gorsuch, since he's taking Scalia's seat. Even if Gorsuch agrees that Roe should be overturned, I don't think Justice Kennedy, who's the current center of the court and will remain so, would do that.
It would take another appointment. That's, I think, when Roe becomes at risk. But, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Come back.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And Ellie Mistal, she mentioned Justice Kennedy. There's this chatter out there that I don't quite understand about Gorsuch having implications for Kennedy.
Yeah,
he clerked for Justice Kennedy, who's the most centrist swing vote on the court. There is speculation that Kennedy, who's 80 years old, might be sufficiently reassured by the Gorsuch appointment that he'll retire, giving Trump an extra pick. What I don't get about that is that Gorsuch seems much more conservative than Kennedy. I think the two of you agreed on that, if nothing else. So if Kennedy retires, he'd be remaking the court in Scalia's image, not his own. So can you explain that speculation?
One of the reasons is that, and we've done a lot of reporting on this on Above the Law, one of the reasons is that Kennedy, I think Scalia's death affected Kennedy. He doesn't want to die at his job, and he has a right to that. Kennedy doesn't owe this country anything more than he's already given it, right? And so if the man wants to retire, he has every right to retire. Now, what does Gorsuch say to him? Gorsuch is Trump's way of saying to Kennedy, look, I'm normal. I'm going to behave. I'm going to nominate normal people. It's not going to be Judge Judy. It's not going to be Steve Bannon. It's going to be a normal guy. Here's a guy that you know he's normal. You can go. That's the signaling that he's saying to Kennedy, and it terrifies me that it might work, but it might work, right? It might give Kennedy some peace of mind that you're saying that, oh, well, if Kennedy leaves, he's going to make the court lurch further to the right. Yeah, but Kennedy's problem is not whether or not the court lurches further to the right necessarily. It's just whether or not the court is going to behave, and Gorsuch is a behavioral pick, right, on that sense. So that's why there's that speculation out there, and it's – we'll see. 4 years is a long time.
Sarah in Hamilton Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I just want to say that I don't think Trump should be able to choose a Supreme Court justice in the last year of his presidency. And, well,
Trump?
I'm not trying to, it's
in
a joke.
In the
last year of his presidency.
Okay, right.
Can we get to...
Go ahead. Actually, it might help if you turn off your radio. I think you're getting confused by the delay. We have a delay, folks. So the people, when they utter one of those words that the FCC doesn't allow us to say without a big fine, we can change time and make it as if that word was never spoken. It rarely happens on this show, but we have that nuclear option if we need to use it. So that's why we ask you to turn your radios down. Anyway, Sarah, go ahead.
Okay, so I hope you can hear me better now. But what I'm saying is that I don't think Trump should be allowed to appoint a Supreme Court justice in the last year of his presidency. And I'm making a joke, but I'm serious in that I think that he's probably going to be impeached. And I think that nothing is normal here. that this is somebody who won't show us his taxes, who, as you say, has authoritarian tendencies. And, you know, I think that his nominees should be treated the same way that Merrick Garland was. And as for one of the previous callers' idea that Democrats should keep their powder dry for what? For when? This is completely unprecedented, and this is the time. If the Republicans want to go nuclear, this is the time.
Boom, Sarah. Look, there's no point in having a filibuster if you can't use it to filibuster the lifetime appointment on the court. I want to pick up on something that Sarah said, that Tim said, and that Esther said, because it's all one thread. How you feel about the Gorsuch nomination has a lot to do with whether or not you feel like he's replacing Scalia or if he's replacing Garland. If you think he's replacing Scalia, having a Scalia clone replace Scalia under a Republican administration is not surprising. If you understand that he's replacing Garland, if you feel that Garland's nomination was stolen from him by Senate Republicans, and I think that would be accurate, then I feel like you have to look at Gorsuch in context of Garland. And that's why I say Trump could have made a centrist pick. You know, if it's going to be his pick, if it's going to be if Republicans succeeded in stealing it, that doesn't mean they then had to go so far to the right with this pick. They could have picked somebody more in the middle. Merrick Garland, for instance, was a centrist, but I understand that he probably wasn't on the shortlist. But there were other centrist Republicans that Trump could have picked if he had any interest in bridging the divide, in healing the country, in starting the healing process. He could have made a much more conservative with a small C, right, pick.
But take me down this road politically. You're a legal analyst, but I think you can do this too politically. Take me down this road where the Democrats do filibuster this nomination. Can they actually stop the nomination by filibustering? They can't filibuster forever and ever, right? And if they succeed in having this nomination withdrawn, there'd be somebody at least equally conservative nominated. So where does that lead?
See, one of the I like to say to my family, one of the reasons why Republicans win is because they don't worry about what happens if they lose. They only worry about what happens if they win. If the Democrats stop this nomination, then Trump will almost certainly have to nominate somebody more centrist. And that is a goal worth having. And that is a goal worth fighting for. Now, if the Democrats filibuster, the only way the Republicans can stop them is if they change the filibuster rules. Now, the Republicans are stomping around talking a big game. Oh, we'll change them if we have to. We'll take the nuclear option. Call their bluff. Make them do it. That's what Republicans did to us. They called our bluff That's what Republicans did to Democrats in the Senate, called their bluff, and the Democrats in the Senate were found wanting. Call the Republicans bluff. Make them do it. Because if you win, what you get is a more centrist lifetime appointment.
Ellie Mistal, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
And thanks again to Elizabeth Price Foley from Florida International University. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come. Stay with us.